Chicago could soon become the biggest American city to try out universal basic income. That's a pilot program that would give $500 a month to 1,000 families with no strings attached.
The economy's changed drastically over the last 40 years. Income inequality is growing at a rapid clip, and automation is around the corner.
That's Alderman Amaya Pawar on WTTW. He joins us. Plus, how a new tax credit in this year's state budget is offering some financial relief to families who want to adopt. Here's Governor Rauner just after the budget was passed.
Many states do not have a tax credit program for adoption. We in Illinois now are moving adoption services forward.
And how scientists at Argonne National Labs have created a sponge that's being used to clean up oil spills off the Pacific coast. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Don't go anywhere. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, adopting a child can be very expensive. The average cost of a domestic adoption is around $30,000, but the state of Illinois is trying to make that easier by becoming one of just a handful of states to offer a tax credit for adoption. Plus, researchers at Argonne National Labs have been testing out a new way to clean up oil spills. It's actually a reusable sponge, and it's already being used to help with cleanup efforts in California. We're going to be talking about both of those topics later on in the hour. But first, have you heard of universal basic income? It's the idea where every citizen receives an amount of money on a regular basis with no strings attached. The idea has gotten more traction in recent years. It's even been tried out in a few American cities. And Alaska has a version of this. It's called the Alaska Permanent Fund. Here in Illinois, one Chicago alderman is pushing for a pilot program to see whether this would work in our state's largest city. Amaya Pawar is the alderman who's putting forth this proposal. He's a Democrat representing Chicago's 47th ward on the city's north side. He's on the line with us now. Hi, Alderman. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start by asking why you think universal basic income is a good idea. Specifically, what are the economic problems you're thinking this would help solve?
Well, I mean, look, income inequality grows every day. 70% of Americans cannot shoulder a $1,000 emergency. One in three parents can't afford to put diapers on their children. 50% of adults will experience poverty in their lifetimes. And many people who live in poverty work full time, and they simply cannot, they don't earn enough to get ahead. So there's that, the reality of widening income inequality. And then you have the coming threat of automation, where lots of jobs in a variety of sectors, from blue collar to white collar positions, will be automated in the near future. It's not science fiction. So we have to start thinking about, well, what does the future of work look like? How do we help those living in poverty today, and what might a solution look like that targets both of those issues? And universal basic income does that.
Why not say raising the minimum wage? You talked about the fact that most people who are working, who are in poverty, are working. Why not look at raising wages more?
In fact, I've worked on that. I worked to raise the minimum wage to $13 an hour. I support a $15 an hour minimum wage. I worked on paid sick leave. I'm working on with a coalition on fair scheduling. But the thing is, a lot of these jobs are also, McDonald's recently announced that they will replace many of their workers with iPad-type stations to order. So a lot of these jobs will be automated. So the question is, what are we doing about the future while helping people today who are working full-time in a lot of these jobs that may be automated live in a dignified manner?
And is the idea with this, who do you think this would help the most? Are you thinking this would be targeted towards working families? What's the idea of who would be able to get this money?
So what we're looking to do is work with the mayor's office to impanel a task force to start thinking about what a pilot cohort could look like. And obviously, the at least my focus would be on working families, those families that are struggling to put food on the table to make ends meet. That would be my focus. Obviously, if you're thinking about it from a universal standpoint, there is no means test. But I believe that we have to start somewhere. And I think there is an opportunity in Chicago with the mayor's leadership and partnership to help a cohort of struggling families. And again, prove that when you help poor people with making ends meet or putting food on the table, that if you provide them with direct cash, that they don't make bad decisions. That narrative of deserving and undeserving, and that poor people make bad decisions when given money, needs to be broken. And we have a major opportunity here in Chicago to prove that out.
And as we think about that narrative that you're talking about, I'm curious about this in the context of, I'm thinking about the farm bill as that's being debated right now and how that conversation is in regards to SNAP benefits or food stamps. And there's a conversation that we need to cut these benefits. Some Republicans argue that that's a disincentive to work, to be giving people more benefits. So what would you say to someone who says that handing out cash is even worse?
What I would say to them is, there are most people who live in poverty, most people who qualify for Medicaid, who receive Medicaid, lots of these folks work full time and yet still can't put food on the table or pay their bills, or they're trapped in a cycle of poverty and debt. So the economy isn't working for them. That is my answer to them. Number two, the idea that, say, for example, people would stop working because of a UBI pilot that provides $500 a month is just nonsense. That's $6,000 a year. No one is leaving a full-time job for $6,000 a year. What this will do is make sure that a family who has a tough time paying their child care or putting diapers on their infant or buying that last week of groceries, that they will be able to do that. And I think there is a case to be made for direct cash rather than always talking about benefits, because I think those benefits are important and they shouldn't go away. But I think on top of that, in the same way that Social Security provides a cash disbursement, universal basic income is also required so that people can make ends meet.
My guest is Chicago Alderman Amaya Pawar. We're talking about a resolution that he's proposed in the Chicago City Council that would call for a pilot program to give $500 a month to 1,000 families. As I mentioned before, this has been tried on a small scale in a couple of cities in California, and Alaska has its own version of this. It's called the Alaska Permanent Fund. Alderman, in Alaska, that fund comes from the billions of dollars in oil revenue. In the case of Chicago, where would you see the money for this pilot project coming from?
So if we impanel this task force, we'll figure out what the size of the cohort is. My instinct is to always go big and go for as big a pilot as possible. We might have to settle on a smaller number. That's fine. The money, we would be seeking out philanthropic support to prove out this point that poor people don't make bad decisions when they have the ability to make decisions about their finances. So we would be seeking philanthropic support. But let me just say this. The federal government, Congress, just passed a $1 trillion tax cut. Over a third of the beneficiaries of that $1 trillion tax cut are sovereign wealth funds, meaning foreign countries who make investments in the stock market. So it's not as if those dollars went to average working class Americans. They didn't go into our neighborhoods. Those tax cuts went to foreign nations and their sovereign funds. So we can find the political will and the ability to cut taxes and, in many ways, provide a direct cash disbursement to wealthy sovereign funds, to the 1%, to the very wealthy. But when it comes to helping our neighbors who are struggling to make ends meet, all of a sudden there are questions about, well, what do we do about accountability? Are people going to leave work? To me, that conversation is nonsense, and that narrative needs to be broken.
Alderman, I just wanted to ask you one last question about, this is something you're trying to implement in Chicago. Is this something that you think would also, in your mind, ideally be needed outside of Chicago and throughout the rest of the state of Illinois as well?
I think this is a conversation. Modernization of the EITC, universal basic income, has to be a state and national conversation, because I always talk about the automation of long-haul trucking. There are 2 million plus jobs connected to that in supply chain and driving the actual truck, the motels, the repair. All of those industries likely will disappear as Amazon and Tesla and these companies invest billions of dollars in taking those jobs away to drive up profits. So what are we going to do? Are we just going to let people be automated out of the workforce, or are we going to provide a social safety net? And are we going to help people who currently work full time and are struggling to make ends meet? And this is why this conversation, because it's things are only happening in major cities, I think Chicago has the opportunity to lead the national conversation so that we can have this in a more rational and honest way.
That's Democratic Alderman Amaya Pawar. He represents Chicago's 47th Ward on the city's north side. Alderman, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the alderman's proposal for a universal basic income and how the city of Chicago, he's proposed, could create a pilot program to see how well this works. When we're talking about income inequality, a recent study by the Economic Policy Institute found that on average in Illinois, the top 1% of income earners make 27 times the amount compared to the other 99%. I'm joined now by Bob Bruno. He's a professor and director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the 21st.
It's nice to be back. Thank you.
Bob, we heard Alderman Pawar talking about automation, and I wanted to ask you, as someone who studies the labor industry, how much do you think automation is a really big challenge to a sector of our labor market going forward?
Yeah, so there have been some recent studies done, and we conducted one at the School of Labor and Employment Relations looking at the potential of automation extending into areas, into industries that heretofore had not been so heavily automated. And the projections are that we're going to see a rapidly increasing use of AI, forms of technology that are going to make actual workers redundant. That technology is going to advance to the point that nearly all work that doesn't require an actual sort of human touch is going to be subject to automation. And so that this is a legitimate concern. We really haven't seen the robots take over yet. And of course, someone's going to have to manufacture the technology. But to think about a universal basic income or a negative income tax as a way to respond to a future that will require fewer people to do work, I think is is a legitimate concern and a legitimate response. Because yes, job loss due to technology, it has already impacted the manufacturing sector in ways that even exceed bad trade deals, but we could expect to see them impacting the service sector and into professional occupations.
Right. So when we're talking about the service sector, for example, the McDonald's example that we talked about earlier, I'm thinking of there's that new McDonald's. Well, it's not the new McDonald's, but it's a McDonald's in downtown Chicago where they have replaced basically all of their clerks with iPads. And there's I think there's one cashier now that McDonald's on State Street in Chicago where mm-hmm. you have to kind of walk in. Is that's the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, it's one of the kinds of things. But it's and of course, we should be really attentive to what's happening in the service sector, because close to two-thirds of all of the jobs that that the modern economy is creating is actually happening in the service sector, where wages are actually below the median wage. So that's one. But even in middle-class paying occupations, like the construction industry, where we see technology created that can pave a road and to lay brick at such a rate, at a certain level of efficiency, that no longer requires quite the same size of a road crew. We'll see it there. We see it in medical record keeping and in the legal profession in terms of collecting and holding data. So there really is not an industry that's immune from this. But even putting aside what the likely or probable impact of technology and automation is to creating job redundancy, we do have a very large, low-wage labor force. And there's a need to address the inability of people to live even reasonably well on wages that are below $15 an hour, that are below $10, $12 an hour, over 60% in the healthcare field, excluding professionals like doctors and nurses, are earning incomes that are below $15 an hour. You've got a quarter of the workforce working for less.
And Bob, when we think about that, right, when you think about how much people are earning and the whole idea of automation, traditionally, when we've thought about how this has happened in the manufacturing sector, the answer has been, let's give people more training. How much do you think a universal basic income, giving people cash, would be another way to solve this? I think oftentimes we've talked more about retraining workers.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not a substitute for retraining workers. It's not a substitute for investing in education. What you're doing with a universal basic income is you're providing a wage floor. You're providing some wealth floor that will actually enable people to stay in the labor market, to stay in the job, that will create some incentives for both the individual and the employer to invest in those workers. So this modest amount that the worker would get with a UBI actually enables them to stay within that job, to invest in it, and to take advantage of what would hopefully be additional professional development. Employers would have a greater incentive to put the money into training, for example, because the burden might be off them in terms of constantly having to weigh to increase the annual wage, the hourly wage. So there can be a shifting of those resources and greater reasons to invest in the worker. So this UBI doesn't supplant other mechanisms for increasing productivity and increasing the value of that worker, but it helps to create the architecture, the conditions upon which these other kinds of investments.
Bob, I'm going to stop you there. Let me just interrupt you for a second. We're going to take a break. We'll come back, continue this conversation on the other side of this short break. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking about automation. We're talking about income inequality and the universal basic income. That's a proposal that has just been made in Chicago City Council to create a pilot program to have some families get $500 a month. Right now, they're talking about 1,000 families getting cash. This program that will help particularly families that are considered working poverty in at the working poverty level. My guest is Bob Bruno. He's a professor. He's also director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois. Bob, I wanted to ask you about something you said. You talked about the idea of a negative income tax, calling this program a negative income tax. And I think when we think about economic policy, there are a lot of things that we like to slot into a spectrum of being on the left and the right. And that term income tax, I think, is often used, like progressives saying they want to raise income tax for wealthier people, conservatives saying they want to cut taxes for higher income earners. We just heard a Democratic Chicago alderman talking about a universal basic income. Is that an idea you would characterize from the left, or do you think it's harder to put it into one category?
Well, it's very interesting, and there's very little around monetary fiscal policy wages that the left and the right can agree to. But on this subject of this idea of a minimum, some sort of wage floor to keep people out of poverty, to help make work pay, there's been a lot of agreement across the political spectrum. So Milton Friedman, the iconic Chicago school economist, he coined the phrase a negative income tax, but it related to the idea that there would be a certain wealth share that would return to all adults and all children. Richard Nixon, 1969, referred to he called it a family assistance plan, and you would use the tax code as a way of addressing this. We have something today called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which could perhaps be modified. And it's very popular with conservatives and with liberals. Charles Murray, a very conservative political scientist, actually talked about advocating a guaranteed income, roughly $10,000 per person. George McGovern from the left in 1972 talked about a grant of $1,000 to.
So this has been around for a while, it sounds like, Bob, and on both sides of the political spectrum, too. So let me ask you one last question then. I think when we talk about, we've been talking this hour about income inequality, we've heard so much of a conversation about automation and what that looks like, what it's looked like over the past few decades, what that may look like in the future. I think we've always had this idea that in America, that if you work hard and if you get a job, you can support yourself and your family. Do you think that's still viable for most Americans?
Well, the painful truth is that is more myth than reality. That's what's most changed about going to work. There was a time that the best way to ensure prosperity and a middle class life was you'd go to work. There was an investment in that job. Very often those jobs were unionized. There was government protections for those jobs. And as you gained seniority, your quality of life improved. I think it's more of a lie now than a reality that you can, through work, through employment, actually ensure prosperity for you and your family. Too many workers are working below that $15 wage, below the $11 wage. Too many workers are only getting 20 hours, 14 hours, 30 hours a week. Millions of workers really don't have adequate health care, and we're simply not creating the kinds of jobs that provide that kind of income security, and we don't have the government institutions. We can't raise the minimum wage at the federal level. Tax policy is really skewed to the wealthy. And of course, there have been attacks on collective bargaining and labor unions. So the idea of the American dream being possible through employment, which should be a strongly conservative principle, not government assist, not government aid, but employment, all of that really, I think, is in serious dispute. And something like UBI is a way to make work pay, to once again incentivize people to stay in the labor force and allow people to work their way to prosperity.
That's Bob Bruno. He's a professor. He also directs the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois. Bob, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
For more than 100,000 children in Illinois' foster care system who are awaiting adoption, and many families who are looking to adopt also look outside the foster care system. But for many people, that process itself can be expensive. The average cost of a domestic adoption is around $30,000. And travel and international adoptions become even much more than that. But now, a new tax credit included in this year's state budget might offer some help for Illinois families who want to adopt. It's modeled after a similar federal tax credit. Earlier this morning, I had a chance to speak with State Senator Dave Severson. He's a Republican who has represented Illinois' 35th District. That's Rockford and the surrounding areas. And in May, he pushed to include this adoption tax credit in the Illinois budget. Senator Severson, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Why did you want to make sure that this tax credit was included, Senator, in the 2018 budget?
Well, we know one of the areas that have always been a struggle is trying to help families both encourage adoption, but then also make it more affordable for families. And what we found in the past is, you know, many families have been interested in adoptions, but then when they look at what the costs are, it just becomes difficult for them to move forward to do that. And with so many children out there that are willing and available for adoption, making it more affordable so families can both adopt, and which is helpful for the families and certainly for these children, that they can get into loving homes.
And Senator Severson, this is something you have personal experience with, correct?
Yes, I did an adoption. Now it's been 26 years ago, and I remember going through all the steps, and I was certainly familiar with the system and made it easier. But to see all the steps that they go through, unfortunately, some of it is just government bureaucracy, but then just some of the cost of paperwork and lawyers, it it can become overwhelming. And we have some great programs through organizations like Children's Home and Aid Society, where they have caseworkers and individuals that assist families along the way, which makes it a whole lot easier. But clearly this tax credit, along with the federal tax credit, is something that will give those families at least some relief. Obviously, there's still going to be a lot of cost out of pocket, but this gives them at least some incentive or additional help.
And how specifically will this state tax credit work, Senator?
Well, the way the tax credit works is if you adopt a child in Illinois or from Illinois, and the child is over 1 year old, so it's not a newborn, you would be eligible for a $5,000 tax credit. Now, that's not a tax deduction, so that's the difference is a tax credit means you save $5,000 in your state income tax, as opposed to a tax deduction where you would just get, you would save the 5% of that. Now, if an individual isn't paying $5,000 in taxes for this year, they could carry that forward. So in other words, if they only paid $3,000 in income tax this year, they would get a $3,000 credit, and then they could carry over the $2,000 and get the credit done next year.
And I mentioned a number at the beginning. As of 2016, there were more than 400,000 children in foster care. That number's been growing. There's more than 100,000 of those children who are awaiting adoption. I'm assuming that you're hoping this will help encourage more families to adopt, especially within Illinois and from our foster care system?
Well, we certainly hope that's the case. What over the years, we've tried to make some changes in foster care, too, and to allow individual foster parents, for example, if they do want to adopt that child. It's been frustrating in the past because there were rules that said if you get too attached to that child or talking about adopting that child, they'll take that foster child out of the home. And that just made no sense. We want people who love on these kids to, if they decide that they want to adopt them, we should want to encourage that. And we've also changed the laws in the past that, you know, we're going to give the birth mother a certain amount of time to get their act together. But after a certain period of time, we need to be looking at what's the best interest of that child and to make it easier to get that child into a permanent adoptive home where they can flourish. So anything we can do to encourage either people who have foster parents or kids that are in the foster system that they could be adopted into loving homes, that certainly is the goal. And we know that it's better for that child long term, and it helps those families that are looking to permanently adopt someone that they can love on and help.
That said, Senator, is there what else would you like to see happen? You talked about the bureaucratic paperwork and things that you personally have experienced. You've mentioned a little bit of that here as well. What's next for you in terms of what further barriers you think need to be removed in Illinois for more families to be able to adopt more children?
Well, I think, again, working with the trying to reduce some of the state bureaucracy, some of the overburdensome or duplicative issues that have to be done would certainly be helpful. And then looking at, again, what is the best interest of that child? Sometimes we're more concerned that just because a person gave birth to that child or was the father of that child, if they're not interested in that child or if they're not interested in getting their act together, these children should not be allowed to, you know, continue to languish from foster home to foster home waiting for that parent to get their act together. And so we need to be really looking at, you know, what is the best interest of that child. And so this is certainly a big step in helping encourage that. And the other thing, I think, is just making the public more aware that there are so many children that are out there that are in need of a loving home, that those families maybe who haven't thought about that, we need to see if we a way to get them more interested in it or more aware of the needs that are out there, and then making those steps easier for them to be able to do that adoption.
State Senator Dave Severson represents Illinois' 35th district, which includes parts of Rockford, Boone, DeKalb, Kane, and Winnebago counties. Senator, thanks for taking the time to be with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for talking about this important topic.
I'd like to welcome two more guests into this conversation now. Sue Puffpaff is the supervisor of adoptive parent services at The Cradle, an adoption agency in Evanston, Illinois, just north of Chicago. Also joining me on the line is Pam Devereaux. She's CEO of the Gift of Adoption Fund. The Gift of Adoption Fund has awarded more than $7 million in grants to families looking to adopt and has helped more than 2,500 children find permanent homes. Sue, Pam, thanks for being here with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So can I just start with that number? We've been talking about the average cost for a domestic adoption anywhere from $25,000 to $30,000. Is that pretty typical for the folks that you've been working with at The Cradle?
Yeah, I think that's pretty typical. You know, we're very transparent in our fees. Everything is on our website at cradle.org. But yeah, there's no doubt that adoption is expensive.
What's behind that number? Where's all that money going, Sue?
It goes to a lot of different places. You know, we always say that you don't pay for your own adoption. You pay for sort of the, you know, the we provide a lot of help with, like, birth parents in terms of rent or, you know, bus passes or things like that. So a lot of it goes to sort of these hidden fees. We don't have families pay birth parents directly. So a lot of the fees that the adoptive parents pay actually go to helping our birth parents with kind of their daily day-to-day lives. They're also, you know, a lot of them are, you know, struggling just with making ends meet, and then you have an unplanned pregnancy, which just makes things a little bit harder.
And I wonder, Sue, do you ever work with families who are interested in adoption but don't go through with all of it primarily because of financial reasons?
There are some. You know, we do kind of take a poll, you know, sort of like the families who've withdrawn throughout the year. It's not as much as you would think, really. We have, there is a lot of availability in terms of grants and loans. There's a lot of employer benefits. Some employers in the Illinois area are just, they're just amazing in terms of what they're willing to give an adoption assistance and benefits and that sort of thing. So the other thing to know, too, is we don't have adoptive families pay a fee in one lump sum. It is really stretched out throughout the adoption process. Some people take 2 to 3 years to even, you know, get through the process from registration with The Cradle to finalization. And so the fees are really, you know, stretched out. So hopefully it's not too much of a burden and we don't have people pay just all at one time.
Pam, when you heard about this tax credit for Illinois, how much do you think that will make a difference for folks or for families who are trying to adopt children?
Yeah, I hope it helps a lot. I think that anything that makes it seem more possible, the Dave Thomas Foundation did some research a while back, and it said that 25% of American families have considered adoption, and then about 2% take those first steps, and 1% complete the process. So for me, anything that will help the 25 increase, you know, go, you know, increase the number of two, the people who are taking positive steps and those who complete would really be seen as positive in my view, simply because, as was mentioned earlier, there's just so many children around the world and in the United States that need homes. To me, the financial barrier should be one of the last things that would keep them at bay.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to continue this conversation. We're talking about adoption across Illinois, a new tax credit that was just adopted as part of the budget this past May that will allow for up to $5,000, as we've been talking to State Senator Dave Severson about this. He was one of the folks instrumental in shepherding this through the state legislature. My guests are Pam Devereaux. She's CEO of the Gift of Adoption Fund. We're going to find out a little bit more about her adoption fund after the break, along with our conversation will continue with Sue Puffpaff, who's supervisor of adoptive parent services at The Cradle. They're an adoption agency based in Evanston. As always, your questions or comments are welcome. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow. And on the other side of the short break, we'll pick up this conversation. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are Sue Puffpaff. She's a supervisor of adoptive parent services at The Cradle. They're an adoption agency based in Evanston, Illinois. Pam Devereaux is also on the line with us. She's CEO of the Gift of Adoption Fund. As we're talking about this issue of a new tax credit that's been offered in Illinois for adoptive families, Pam, can I just ask you about, you all have awarded more than $7 million in grants to families that are looking to adopt. What kind of costs do that go to, these grants that you offer? What kind of costs do those help with?
Right. So our grants actually are the last funds needed to complete an adoption. So typically our grants are going to be funding final travel, finalization, those type of things, which are really the final costs a family has to experience in order to complete an adoption. You know, when I think about adoption costs, I sort of, we put it into three buckets. There's the first piece of getting the family vetted and prepared. There's the second piece, which is the legal transaction. And then the third piece is really traveling home. The first part of being home is getting there. And so families have to navigate all of that. We join them. So the families who are applying to Gift of Adoption have to have at least half of the adoption costs funded, and then they can apply for consideration. And we look to see that they have a bona fide financial need, that they've been matched with a child or a birth mom. And then we come alongside them just so that they'll continue to be able to persevere in the process. We provide that last 10 to 20% of the cost to get the kid home safe and sound into a family who will be their forever family.
And we've been talking about the costs of all of this, and I wanted to just end by asking both of you, and Pam, let me start with you. Do you think finances are the biggest hurdle? What do you think the biggest challenges are when it comes to adopting children, the barriers to that happening?
Well, I think, you know, for me, I think there's a heart for adoption. I think for me as an adoptive parent, it was a very important personal decision for me. It was something, the more I learned about it, the warmer it felt, and I was excited to do it. So I think it's not for everybody, right? But for those who are interested in building their family that way, who care about doing things for the children who need families, I think anything that we can do to reduce the barriers, I think misconceptions are a primary barrier. I think timing can be really tough. I think more and more the children who are available for adoption aren't always the youngest, healthiest children. And I think funding is definitely a primary barrier. So I think you have to take a very combined approach. And just, you know, with counselors like what's happening at The Cradle, really people having trusted people to walk through this process with, so that each of those respective barriers can be mitigated. Or if it's not right for that family, what's compelling about Gift of Adoption is many people come to us because adoption is not right for them, but they want to help a child get into a family. So we always say you don't have to adopt to give a child a family. You can help your neighbor, a fireman, a teacher, a policeman nearby who wants to adopt but just can't make that financial barrier work. So I think there's lots of ways all of us can come together to address the need of these children, millions around the world and in the United States. I heard a statistic that it's about a 1.5% probability of being adopted if you're an orphan. It means almost 99% of them won't have a family. And for us, that's just totally not okay. And I know many, many people feel that way. So I hope this conversation is phenomenal. And I think just coming together to tackle each of those respective barriers for each individual family and continue to try and get it done.
Sue, to that point about misconceptions, as we're ending this conversation, what do you think the biggest ones are out there that you want people to miss, you want to dispel about adoption?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do agree with Pam. Like, I don't think it's a kind of a one size, you know, one thing issue. It is a combination of things. I do think that people think, you know, that the cost is prohibitive, which I think if you really kind of do your research, that there are ways, like we talked about earlier, in terms of, you know, grants and employer benefits, and you know, there's just a lot of the ways to kind of fund the adoption. You know, the way the Cradle works is you pay, you know, sort of your fee, and then you can be looked at and matched with a birth mom one time or 20 times, and you don't pay any more than that one-time fee. So I know other adoption agencies do a little bit more a la carte, but that is the way we do it, which is great, because the families know up front, you know, what you're going to be in for, and that's it. There's no other hidden fees there, too. And we do have reduced fees for, you know, African-American parents. We're always recruiting for African-American parents. For parents who are open to more of a medically fragile, special needs child, there are reduced fees for that. So we're really trying to, you know, kind of recruit the families that we really need for the children that we're placing right now. So I would really hope that people, you know, kind of take a look at more than just the fees and more about our overall approach and our program and, you know, how we do adoptions ethically and the right way.
I want to thank Sue Puffpaff. She's with The Cradle, Pam Devereaux with Gift of Adoption, for being with me to talk about this. Ladies, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
We hear about innovation, incubation, and invention all the time, but what do those real words really mean? And do we ever see the fruits of all of that labor and research? Well, if you're part of a team of scientists who are trying to clean up oil spills off the coast of California, the answer is yes. Researchers from Argonne National Laboratories, are about an hour and a half southwest of Chicago, created a sponge to clean up ocean oil spills, and they successfully tested it out on the Pacific coast. Not only that, but just like our sponges at home, the sponges can be reused. And again, joining me now to talk about the project and his trip out west to test the sponge out is Argonne National Labs nanoscientist Seth Darling. Hi, Seth. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. How are you?
So, Seth, you're part of the team that invented this oleo sponge?
That's what we're calling it, yeah.
How big is this? In my mind, I was thinking this was, until I saw the video, I was thinking this was a very big sponge.
Well, I mean, you can scale it to be any size you like. In the lab, we tested with pretty small scale.
It's like Swiffer sized in the lab, right?
Yeah, or even smaller, you know, just little, you know, kitchen sponge size pieces. But it can be scaled up dramatically to address a large spill if necessary.
So how does this work? Can you explain to us how you figured this out?
Yeah, sure. So what you need if you want to try and soak up a spill instead of doing what they do today with oil spills and water bodies, which is skimming it off the oil or burning it or things like that. If you want to soak it up, you need something that will soak up the oil and not the water. So it has to be selective. And you need another feature, which is you have to be able to reuse it. You want to be able to extract that oil out of the sponge that you soaked up and then reuse the sponge over and over again. Otherwise, you'll never have enough of it to address a large spill. So what you need is to change the chemistry of the sponge so that it loves oil and hates water. And that's really where the science is, where the magic is to get something that works like oleo sponge.
And how hard was it to create that? And especially the idea that it had to be something that's reusable. Was that particularly challenging?
Yeah. So there are materials out there that are used sometimes with oil spills that are not reusable. So they soak up oil, but then what you have is a big chunk of hazardous waste, which they typically will burn, which, you know, solves a water pollution problem, but creates an air pollution problem. So that's not great. So yeah, it's not trivial to make something that will hold on to the oil tightly enough to pull it out of the water, but will let it go. And in this case, with a simple squeeze, you don't want to have to wash it with harsh chemicals or something like that, because now, again, you're creating hazardous waste. The idea here is everything is reusable and there's no waste in the process.
Now, you tested this out. What part of California did you choose as your test site? How did that go?
Well, we didn't choose it. Mother Nature chose it for us. So a lot of folks don't realize, but not only do we sometimes accidentally spill oil into the water just as part of oil and gas operations, but Mother Nature is actually always spilling oil into the water in a few places around the earth that are called oil seeps. They're natural oil seeps where some crude oil and natural gas and other things leak out from the seafloor. And, you know, because oil tends to be lighter than water, it will float up to the surface. And so we went out to this Coal Point oil seep, which is near Santa Barbara, just up the coast from Santa Barbara, to do a test. Of course, it's not legal to intentionally put oil in the water. So if you want to do a test, what you got to do is find some oil that's already there.
And I wonder, how different were lab conditions from when you tested this at Argonne to when you were out off that coast? What was different about the real-world test?
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's all kinds of things that are the same and all kinds of things that are different. Some of the things that are different is, one is you're on a boat and you're deploying from a boat. And that was one of the big reasons we wanted to go out and do this field test, was to demonstrate that not only can you do this in the lab or in a more controlled environment, but you can go out there where oil spills actually happen and have the thing function. You could imagine there could be debris on the water. You know, you don't know what state the oil is in, because it actually, the chemistry and physical properties change as it sits out there under the sunlight and with the waves and with the reactions with the seawater and so on. And so lots of stuff is different, and you know, you never know if it's going to work until you try. So we were really thrilled to see how well it performed out there.
So it performed out there, and then you do you also have, so there's the sponge, but then I imagine there's also another device that has to be portable that's on the boat to wring out the sponge and get the oil out of the sponge so you can use it again?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way we've been operating this. It's just the simplest possible idea. You soak up the oil, you bring the sponge onto deck, and you squeeze it out, and you get it back out there again. And, you know, in a spill situation, you do that as quickly as possible. In our case, we're just using a wringer to squeeze it out. It's super simple.
I'm talking to Argonne National Laboratory nanoscientist Seth Darling about this oleo sponge invention. And Seth, I imagine environmentalists are obviously taking note of this, something that could be used in potential oil spill cleanups. But for our listeners, do you see any other applications that might come from this science?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. So what we're doing here is we're starting with a really cheap and plentiful raw material, polyurethane foam, which is manufactured on a huge scale. You're probably sitting on it right now if you're on a seat cushion. But polyurethane foam doesn't have this selectivity for oil versus water. What we do is we manipulate the chemistry on the surface of that foam, that sponge, to make it, in this case, like oil and hate water. But we could do a very similar strategy, but with a different chemistry to target other things. And so you could imagine other water pollutants that you might want to pull out of water, or even entirely different applications outside of pollution remediation altogether, where you want to selectively absorb something and not something else.
And Seth, as we're talking about this water issue, I wanted to ask you about another project that the Department of Energy has just tapped Argonne for that you're involved with the Energy Frontier Research Center. You're also going to be looking at this broader issue, and you're doing some more research into water and water cleanup?
Yeah, that's right. So water and energy, we're here at a Department of Energy laboratory at Argonne National Lab, and energy and water are deeply interconnected with one another. We use massive amounts of water in the energy sector, and we also use lots of energy in the water sector. It's actually the largest use of electricity in the United States is to treat and distribute water. A lot of people don't realize that. And so, you know, we're very interested in all kinds of aspects of water, all the way from the very fundamental science all the way to applications like what we were just talking about with the oleo sponge. And this Energy Frontier Research Center is focused more on that fundamental science piece, really understanding the interactions between water and materials, which you would think would be well understood after centuries of investigation, but it's actually a shockingly poorly understood system. Water is a very complicated material, despite its apparent simplicity.
It's not just H2O, in other words.
Well, it is, but how it interacts with both with other water molecules and also with everything around it is really surprisingly complex. Water's known as the most anomalous material we know of.
And just one final question then, Seth. I imagine this is important as we think about water also being perhaps a limited resource going forward.
Yeah, that's right. So we are facing increasing water stress globally. In some cases, it's already a crisis, as we saw in Cape Town, South Africa, for example, just this past year, where they nearly ran out of water in a developed country in a major city. Those types of crises, small and large scale, will be happening with increasing frequency and severity going forward. So we really need not only policy and infrastructure solutions, but lots of science and technology to help us work through these challenges with new solutions.
These challenges being addressed by Illinois scientists right here in Illinois at Argonne National Laboratories. I want to thank Seth Darling, who's a nanoscientist there and now working with this Energy Frontier Research Center. Thanks for being with me, Seth. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
That does it for us today. On tomorrow's program, maybe right now you are stuck on the road in a construction zone. Well, tomorrow we're going to be talking about whether enough is being done to fix our roads and bridges. That does it for us today, though. Do you have the NPR One app, by the way? You can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. You can always find past shows there. It's pretty simple. You download it, set your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, you can easily listen to past shows that way. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. We'll tweet out, by the way, a great video of Seth testing out that oleo sponge that Argonne National Labs did, if you want to follow that. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Penlilio was our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. See you back here tomorrow.